Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
After yesterday, this is going to seem like a walk in the park, actually a crawl in the park. We have less material to look at, but it's such a typical story. We'll spend some more time talking among ourselves today. As we look at this piece that I've... Turn the tape on, please. This piece that I've, for purposes of getting you in the door, called Yahweh, Would You Please Move Over? For those of you who haven't met me before, I'm Peter Nash, and I'm a professor of Old Testament interpretation at Garrett Seminary in Evanston, Alabama. And these 2 weeks that I'm here, we'll be looking at the book of 1 Samuel. And 1 Samuel 8 is the piece in which the Israelites decide that they need to have a king just like everyone else. And let's start right in with 1 Samuel 8, 1 through 9. Someone can read that for us.
When Samuel became old, he made his sons judges over Israel. The name of his firstborn son was Joel, and the name of his second, Abijah. They were judges in Beersheba. Yet his sons did not walk in his ways, but turned aside after gain. They took bribes and perverted justice. Then all the elders of Israel gathered together and came to Samuel at Ramah, and said to him, "Behold, you are old, and your sons do not walk in your ways. Now appoint for us a king to govern us like all the nations." But the thing displeased Samuel when they said, "Give us a king to govern us." And Samuel prayed to the Lord. And the Lord said to Samuel, "Hearken to the voice of the people and all that they say to you. For they have not rejected me, but they have rejected me from being king over them, according to all the deeds which they have done to me from the day I brought them out of Egypt, even to this day, forsaking me and serving other gods. So they are also doing to you. Now then, hearken to their voice. Only you shall solemnly warn them and show them the ways of the king who shall reign over them."
Thank you. Look at the first three verses about Abijah and Joel. And just a couple things. In the morning Bible study, earlier Bible study, I suggested that maybe being the judge, the military, political, moral leader in Beersheba was sort of like being the mayor of Holden Village or Stehekin. If this is inhabited Israel, this is Beersheba down here, and all this is desert. And there's even today in modern Israel, there's nothing else in Israel. A couple of experimental agricultural communities, and then a big resort community. When one of the things that the Israelis were really careful to do when they negotiated the peace treaty was to make sure they had this little corner between Jordan, between Aqaba and Taba, where they would have access to the Red Sea and have this resort city. It's quite nice if you ever get there. It's less fun. But Beersheba is the last, even today, the last city in what most people would consider civilized Israel. Everything else down here is desert. You get into the Great Rift Valley, and it looks like moonscape. It's spectacular. But being judged down here is sort of like being the mayor of Holden, the chief magistrate of Stehekin. There's not much else there. Nevertheless, these guys found a way to be corrupt rulers. And the people knew that. Have we seen anything like this before? For those of you who have been here looking at 1 Samuel. It's like Eli and his children. And Samuel, whom we know from the story, the text keeps telling us what a good guy he is, and they'll tell us a little more along the way, doesn't, even though he's grown up in this very situation and comes to leadership because of the failure of the father to recognize his son's culpability, he doesn't see it in his own sons, and he's ready to put them on the throne. So we get, we don't have a throne technically yet. He's ready to put them in leadership, but the people are not not excited about the idea, and they tell him, no, this isn't going to work. And they ask for a king like everyone else. And back to the map for a minute. All the people that are around them, except for the Philistines, whom we talked about some yesterday, who are from out here somewhere. What did we decide, Sweden or? are people that the Israelites remember as their distant cousins. You have the Edomites down here, who are the offspring of Esau. The Moabites here, who are, and the Ammonites, who are.
Those would be good. Where are the Ammonites?
Moabites and then Ammonites. Mm-hmm. Just across the Jordan, right? Who are descendants of Lot from Genesis 19? Genesis 19. After
pillar of salt.
After Mrs. Lot goes back and turns into a pillar of salt, and the daughters are distressed that they will not. No men will want them. And if you had a family and a god like that, I guess I wouldn't want to marry into it either. And then the Arameans up here, who are Rachel and Leah come from this family. So Jacob's in-laws are up here. So all these people around them who do have kings are their cousins. And they remember this in their genealogies as you read through Genesis and as you read through other stories. They're not cousins that they like very much. They talk about the odd cousins, the ones that you don't want to visit on the holidays but have to. But nevertheless, they understand themselves to be somewhat like them and want to have the same things that they have. I want to ask you to, again, break up into groups that you're comfortable talking with, not necessarily run across them and find someone, but the size of the group that you're most comfortable with, and talk about the ways that you compare yourselves with other folks, college classmates, neighbors, people that you regard as somewhat your parallels, and how that might get in the way of understanding what God is calling you to do or asking you to do in a particular situation, or how God is asking you to live. Ourselves with others, and one of the points I think that is going to be is being made here is that in this particular situation, the king that they want to replace is as good a king as you're ever going to get. We talked a little bit yesterday about the ancient Near Eastern ideas about warfare. And we're going to look at Deuteronomy 17 in just a minute, and why they want, like, is it, and I always get these two confused because they're usually together all the time. In Deuteronomy 17, no, it's here. It's the response. Why do we want the king? Well, to go out before us in battle. Well, if you've got the creator of the universe going out to fight your wars with you, why would you want a tall, handsome guy? It seems so clear. If you've got your kid and your kid is going to be your kid, well, why would you want somebody else's? Because they're going to be them, and none of these kids is ever going to be you. We've had our chance. Whether they go to prison or medical school doesn't mean that I should be in prison or medical school. The ministry on one corner of the street in Tacoma meets one set of needs, and if I happen not to be at that church, perhaps my church has different needs to meet, different ministries to perform, and they'll do theirs and we'll do ours, and that's why there are two churches. Maybe that was God's plan for Sven and Ali to have this big fight in 1955 and split the church in this league. First and second Lutheran grew up two blocks apart. The church I was ordained in, it just so happens that that's what happened 60 years ago, and then 22 years ago, they got back together. They were literally a block apart. And now they're one church serving that community after about 40 years of separation. So we just, this business of comparison, which we are very trained to do, sometimes intentionally, just when parents try to get kids to get their shoes tied or their orange juice drunk, to the media blitz that we see on every other page of magazines. You know, next time you pick up your favorite magazine, look and see how much of it is telling you to be dissatisfied with who you are and how you should be like somebody else. And when you watch television, remember that 12 minutes out of every half hour are spent with someone telling you you should be doing something else, whether it's watching another television show or buying something. It's 8 minutes. About 22 minutes of entertainment or information in every half hour, which is why I shouldn't be in an engineering program. I don't compare myself to engineers when it comes to math. Then this is the problem that the Israelites have with their cousins. They're doing it this way, but the Moabites are called to be the Moabites, and the Ammonites the Ammonites. The Israelites were called to be the Israelites, and they had another route to go. And I'm convinced, if you read the whole story, you find that we actually needed the Moabites for the story to be full. We needed the Ammonites. We needed the Arameans. I mean, where would Jacob have been when he ran away from Esau if there hadn't been a Laban to run to a Rachel and a Leah to marry? Well, we needed the Arameans, at least for part of the story. Where there would have been no David without Ruth, who was the Moabites. All of these people play the story and make Israel what they are. I don't think the entire nation of Moab was established for the sake of giving us David, but remember that when we get to the description of who the king should be. His great-grandmother, great-great-grandmother, was in fact for him. Any questions or comments about this the text itself, or how we tend to compare ourselves almost automatically to someone else? Let's flip back. Keep your finger in 1 Samuel. We'll be back there in just a minute. But let's flip up back to Deuteronomy 17, verse 14 and following. Deuteronomy 17, verse 14, I think it's 20. This is what a king is supposed to be like. And this is actually maybe retroactive in the text, permission to have a king. When you have come into the land that the Lord your God has given you and have taken possession of it and settled in it, you shall say, I will set a king over me like all the nations that are around me. You may indeed set over you a king whom the Lord your God will choose. One of your own community you may set as king over you. You are not permitted to put a foreigner over you who is not of your own community. Even so, we still have that rule in our Constitution, right? You have to be born on this soil. Even so, he must not acquire for himself many horses, or return the people to Egypt in order to acquire more horses, since the Lord has said to you, you must never return that way again. And he must not acquire many wives for himself, or else his heart will turn away. Also, silver and gold he must not acquire in great quantity for himself. Well, what's the point of being king? When he has taken the throne of his kingdom, he shall have a copy of this law written for him in the presence of the Levitical priest. It shall remain with him, and he shall read it all the days of his life, so that he may learn to fear the Lord his God, diligently observing all the words of this law and these statutes, neither exalting himself above other members of the community, nor turning aside from the commandments, either to the right or to the left, so that he and his descendants may reign long over his kingdom in Israel. This is what kingship is supposed to be. It's a gift from God to the community to preserve the people. It's not much different from this judgeship that we've seen, in that it's the judge took the leadership for a particular cause, rescued the people, ruled, but then sort of stepped back into the community. Certainly his descendants were just regular Joes and Janes. But for the, and now we're beginning to talk about it, he and his descendants shall rule, continue to rule. Nevertheless, this person is not to be exalted above the rest. And this person is not to pile up for himself riches, in the case of the king, many wives, many horses. We have to talk to Michael Jordan about his car collection. This is, you kind of look at this and say, like, really, what's the point? You know, why take on all those headaches if you're not going to get something out of it? And obviously, in the U.S. Senate and the House of Representatives, our representative, famous Representative Rostenkowski seems to have not read this passage every day of his life. We don't know yet. He's innocent until proved guilty. The trappings of power in most political systems are just this. Much money, many women or men these days, and the ability to get things done for one's own self, and maybe an occasional thing or two for the constituency to make right around election time. And it's not a new story. This is the way power has always been used. And something different was supposed to happen in Israel. This is the idea of one who would not be there. We've already seen in Beersheba, this little kind of hick town, it wasn't working that way with even Samuel's son. People must have been tapping their feet, knowing if they knew this passage from Deuteronomy, what a king is supposed to do, or if they had an idea of what kind of leadership they wanted. And Samuel gives them this warning that we're going to read now, which sounds a lot like this piece from Deuteronomy 17. If someone would read verses 10 through 18 about the warning that he has to give, that God tells him to give the people.
So Samuel answered those who were asking him for a king. And he told them all that Yahweh said to him. Look, these will be the demands of your king. He will take your sons and assign them to his chariots, be his horsemen, or to run before his chariots. Some he will assign as commanders over 1,000 men, and commanders over 50. He will take your sons to till his own ground, and to reap his own harvest. Make his implements of war, the equipment for his chariots. He will take your daughters as well to prepare perfumes, to cook and to bake for him. He will take the best of your fields, your vineyards, and your olive orchards, and give them to his officials. He will take a tenth portion of your grain and of your vineyards and give it to his officers and his servants. He will take your manservants and maidservants, the best of your cattle and your asses for his work, his own work. He will take the tenth of your flocks, and you yourselves will become his slaves. When these things happen, you will cry out because the king whom you have chosen for yourselves, by then Yahweh will not answer you.
Yeah, and today we say, gosh, I'd be happy if the king would only take 10. any reflection on this? Anything else strike you?
Well, back in Deuteronomy, I was wondering how it says the king is the one whom the Lord has chosen. Mm-hmm. Are there any other directions there on how we're going to know that to see the chosen one.
But it, yeah, if we, as we read through Samuel, we see that there's that is problematic. We'll talk about that in just a minute. How it could be, we're just beginning of 9, why Saul is the choice. And it's still the way we generally pick presidents. No, if you're tall and good looking.
And from a powerful family.
And from a powerful family. If since 60, with the exception, I think, of this last election, we've always elected the taller of the two remaining candidates when they got down to slugging out. Tall and good looking and from a wealthy family, a powerful family.
Well, I think that just follows along with all of the dress for success research that the gentleman discovered. He could go out and show people pictures of models, say which one is the bank president, and Americans would pick the bank president simply on looks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One of this is Malloy's book, Dress for Success. One of the things that really shocked me is that if you go out in a busy Chicago, New York street, dressed like this, and walk across the light, no one will follow you. Or a few crazy people will find you. But if you step out across the light, against the light in a suit, more people, more crazy people. And an example that we make in this country, we make more on average. You know, it's not saying there aren't a lot of short, wealthy people, but on average, your height, if you're taller, you'll make more money. And I heard those. That kind of research, and I was just stunned. But then 6 years ago, I moved to a community called Beaumont, just north of Chicago. Chicago's North Shore is where the money is. And the further north you go to a certain point, so just before Wisconsin, the more money you have. Those people have houses there, work in Chicago, and go to Wisconsin, Lake Geneva, to get away from Illinois. But you don't need to know that. In Womack, living in Womack was the first time in my life that I, on average, looked people in the eye rather than looking down at people. I mean, I'm only, you know, not quite 6'1", but it was striking to me how many tall men lived in Womack that never noticed that anywhere else. And it's a corollary, and what I noticed was a corollary between height and ability to make money.
Ross Perot didn't fit that.
Ross Perot didn't get elected. didn't even get elected.
You did your caucus, what they called in the 7th March that year.
When I hear this read, it seems to me that the person writing it knows the kings of Israel pretty well.
Yeah.
And kings in general.
Yes. This is a piece probably written in the last third of the 7th century, probably during the reign of Josiah, which is only about 50 years before, not even 50 years before the exile, about 40 years before the exile. And so this is, a lot of this is in tradition, but written with a good deal of hindsight.
One of the, it seems too that among other things, the king was usurping in a way that, or taking that which was rightfully due Yahweh, the best of the produce and the tenth of grain and flocks that you know, it might have been just a tax, but certainly someone reading this would have understood that to be the Lord's portion, right, so to speak, rather than the king's. And the king, it seems, is then stepping into Yahweh's shoes.
Yeah. Well, in the ancient Near East, religion was state business. You know, you have to get out of the University of Chicago, Near Eastern language program, you got to remember two things, at least the history part. Religion is state business, and trade is a royal monopoly. The king, even in Israel, in some portions, you look at Psalm 110, is the adopted son of the God. The shepherd, the adopted son, I take him by the hand, tell him to sit up, put your enemies at your footstool. A lot of people don't like to say that about Israel, but there are remnants of it slipping into Israel's worship language. And so for most other nations, there's no problem for the king to take part of what belongs to the god, because the king is in the clearest places in Egypt, where the living king, the dead king, becomes the god. There's a cyclical piece. The dead king becomes the god, and the new king is the god's son. The new pharaoh is the god's son. So they didn't have a problem with it. But for the Israelites, or the Israelite religious writers, they are, that's writers, W-R-I-T-E-R. They didn't like this. They wanted to maintain a separation. And during the monarchy, this is a real problem. If you, the chart I use in class a lot, if you look at Moses and Joshua and the judges as a group, and then Samuel as a transitional character, and talked about religious leadership and political, military leadership. These all converge in these characters. Moses is the religious leader, he's the moral leader, he's the military leader, he's the political leader. And the judicial leader. Same with Joshua, same with each of the judges, same with Samuel. But when you get down and you finally appoint Saul as king, then you begin to see this Saul as a political leader, and for a time, for the remainder of his life, and then even coming back from the grave, when Saul goes to the necromancer, you've got Samuel as the moral religious leader. And the first thing he does when Saul goes and consults this necromancer, pops up and says, "You made a law against necromancers. What are you doing bringing me back from the dead?" So it immediately goes to the religious piece to criticize the political leader. And with David, you've still got this division somewhat with Nathan over here. Only David actually listens to Nathan. When Nathan confronts David, David repents immediately. But once you go down a couple more steps, then there's a sharp division between religious leadership and political leadership. With the prophets constantly, especially in the Northern Kingdom, because we've got a southern version of the story, criticizing everything that the kings do. Primarily because in the Northern Kingdom, they're worshiping up here, and they're not worshiping in Jerusalem. But even in the South, religion, politics have taken held sway over religion, and so the religious material is constantly berating. The prophets are constantly criticizing the kings for taking from, not protecting the widow and the orphan, taking from the poor, the seizing property, not making sure that justice is proclaimed and instituted throughout the land, because this is the nature of kingship.
Peter?
Yes?
In that split, when that split happens, was the size and the population of the Israelites growing? Was it like specialization needed because it was so much bigger now? Is that anything?
It is growing. It is becoming, there is more centralized, the government becomes more centralized under David, and especially under Solomon, where things, Solomon is the real economic heyday of Israel, greater Israel, just before they split into two kingdoms. I don't know that you can say that it's a planned division of
things. No, just organically, as you go from 10 to 50 to 100 to 1,000 to 10,000 at some point in time. You can't keep it under one person.
Yeah. Others manage to do it, but it only seems to manage to be possible when religion will submit to politics. And what happens here is, especially in the later period, religion, moral leadership refuses to submit to political leadership. And is sometimes killed for it. You know, Jeremiah gets thrown into a pit by the king. Several prophets are murdered by kings through the history of Israel. But it's they can stay together if religious moral leadership will submit to political leadership. And it happens in other places in the Near East. Yes?
It would seem the primary motivation might be the threat of military from other countries where they would have someone who could deal with them.
I'm glad you brought that up. Let's go to 19, and then I'm going to ask you one more time quickly to break up into groups. 19 through the end of the chapter. Someone would read that.
The people paid no attention to Samuel, but said, "No, we want a king, so that we will be like other nations, with our own king to rule us and to lead us out to war and to fight our battles." Samuel listened to everything they said, and then went and told it to the Lord. The Lord answered, "Do what they want and give them a king." Then Samuel told all the men of Israel to go back home.
Okay. What do they want? They want to be like other nations, and they want someone to go out in front of us in battle. Now, this has been God's job. I mean, Egypt, at the time, the story of the Exodus is a phenomenal story, because what it says is this little piddling family that has grown to some phenomenal size, as families do over 400 years, with the help of God, defeats one of the two major powers in the world. You've got the Mesopotamians, at that time probably would have been, well, they would have been in, it would have either been Assyria or Babylon, probably the Assyrian, Middle Assyrian kingdom, which ruled everything this is half of the known world, basically. They're not doing too much traveling out here yet, although the sea peoples are about to come in. And you've got Egypt down here ruling all of Africa, along the coastlands here, and usually owning this part of the world, this part of the Levant, and the Assyrians, at this point, owning this part of the Levant. Because this God comes along and says, "Let my people go," and leads them out with a pillar of fire and a cloud to protect them, parts the sea, according to the story, actually makes heaven and earth move so that they can get out of there, they are able to defeat the strongest military force in the world. They would rather have some tall, good-looking guy out in front of them in battle.
Charlton Heston.
Charlton Heston, Ollie North, I don't know.
He's too short.
Powell, as we read in the beginning of 9, Saul's a head and shoulders above everybody and very handsome and comes from a powerful family. They would rather have someone else than the Lord. That's why this session is entitled, "Yahweh, Will You Please Move Over?" As far as I can tell, he's been doing just fine as a military leader. They just can't see him all the time. So the question I want you to turn to your groups again and ask is, what does it mean to be like other nations? What do you get out of our continued propensity to use the military to make us a nation? And it's two questions already. And are you willing to be a slave to your government for that privilege? To have the best of everything go to the military? Which is kind of a touchy question for the people from the Seattle area, people from St. Louis area, who might work for Boeing or Don Douglas or GM if you're from Michigan. It all really does come home for all of us. Some of us more directly than others. How much do we want to be like other nations, that is, have this military preeminence? What price are we willing to pay? The remaining superpower, how much do we turn over to maintain what we have? Through our military strength, our now waning technological, at least in some areas, advantages over the rest of the world, supported in large part by the government, through tax breaks and incentives and so on.
We sacrifice incredible resources, just vast resources, for the sake of the military-industrial complex. I heard a statistic shortly before coming up here that in the streets of our cities, there are more teens and youths killed every year than soldiers were killed in Vietnam during the entire war or conflict. You know, what kind of an example do we set? If our society is such a travesty of justice, and yet we go over to, you know, to Saudi Arabia and say, hey, you got to shape up.
You got to shape up.
No, we start shooting everybody.
Is that a statistic anybody else knows about? I mean, I'm just questioning that statistic.
Yeah, of 50,000 teenagers
a year.
I haven't read that one. I know in Chicago, as of the time that we left, they had reported 40 kids under 15 who had been murdered.
Jeez.
Murdered in Chicago or Green suburbs.
Seattle, Tacoma, probably about the same.
It's getting terrible out there.
Probably worse than
that. But see, that doesn't begin to approach 50,000.
No.
Right, so I just question the statistics.
Well, you do 1,000 cities at 50 each is 50,000.
I know in Sacramento there's usually one a day, at least, a teenager.
It can happen to a day.
And it's not just murder, it's people who die from child abuse, because of inadequate resources, people who die of any other issues.
That will add it up.
We can sell for a lot. There are a lot of them being killed.
And if you look over history of the last couple of decades, and every conflict that we've gotten involved in on Hornchuk, what have we actually solved? We actually accomplish any democratic. And why aren't we on the side of keeping peace, of, you know, hey, let's sit down and talk, instead of taking in guns and tanks and so forth, and bombers, and killing innocent people? If we think we're such a moral and just society.
Well, to some extent, it's a question of how you do that.
Getting back to family, but we keep talking about we need the family basis. Is the government going to handle all this? That's my idea.
But I think the question becomes, why are we so much more willing to spend money on military equipment than we are on supporting family?
I thought we'd come down quite a bit on military. We're working toward getting that down in shape.
I question that. I think we're spending just as much as ever.
Try as best you can.
I think the healthcare initiative might be a sign of that. Mm-hmm. If that ever flies, I was stunned when I heard National Public Radio, liberal bastion in America, immediately after the election, start to talk about what it's going to cost me as someone who's well insured to have national healthcare. Mm-hmm. What did we think was going to happen?
Yeah.
Somehow it's always going to come out of somebody else's pocket, right, in order to make sure that everybody gets somewhere near full coverage.
I think what we do with our resources will depend largely upon who gets the microphone and tells us what our problem is. And right now we have just a chaos, babble of voices saying, over here, over here, over here, over here, there, there, and problem, problem, problem. and some of us just come to hold them.
But
we hear another babble.
But whoever, I'm saying, the seizing of the high ground is the guy who gets the microphone and says, "Read my lips. It's healthcare, healthcare, healthcare." Then, oh, if we agree on that, then our resources come around and they go that way. As long as those people in St. Louis and those people in Seattle are employed, we keep a lot of this stuff going just because we don't know what else to do with it. Do you want more people on the street unemployed? And so we keep making the swords, even though we could really use the plowshares, because we can't stop the process. We've started it. So I'm looking to see who's going to persuade us that this is the primary problem. Whoever can tell, if we can agree that this is the problem, then our resources will follow. Right now, we're a confused lot. One thing we're agreed upon, we're not doing it right.
Well, we do have a deficit reduction law. That's a start. Okay.
You know who has the microphone and is telling us what the problem is? Rush Limbaugh.
It seems that way at times. It really
my
does.
Set doesn't get his stage.
What a surprise, huh?
Yes.
I want to know, what do God's people do at this point?
What do God's people do at this
what
point?
What do we as God's people do at this point? We can sit here and talk about blame everybody and all that stuff, but just like hearing about the peace and all that, I think we begin in prayer. I can't see any other place, because we're not wise enough. Obviously, none of us are wise enough.
Well, excuse me.
Time for the year of the Jubilee.
Me the king, me the king.
But one of the points of this kind of a Bible study is to say, here in the text, they're telling us exactly what God's people do, and that is say, give us a king like
everyone else.
That's right. And that we cannot presume to separate ourselves from everyone else out there, whether it's by coming to Holden, by going to church, by going to synagogue, going to mosque, and saying we're different and we're not part of this ugly mess of saying my kid's more important than your kid, my health care is more important than your health care. All of us do it. Each one of us does it. Maybe not in all the same places. And the first step, I think, is the realization that we're doing it. And I think you're right, the next step is to pray and to work in the places where we find ourselves.
Right.
Let's ask God if he wants the job back.
Yeah. And hope she says yes.
part of it is in discussion too with people. I mean, it's awfully hard, it seems to me. If I, you know, I don't listen to Rush Limbaugh, but I know there are a lot to do, and I mean, I've heard him from time to time. But to enter into discussions and dialogues with people in a non-combative way, mm-hmm. and that's really hard for me to do. You know, I don't take that road too often. But it seems to me that in the Christian community, there is a way in preaching and in teaching to help folks see what it is that this Christian faith of ours is all about. You know, we've got Old Testament models, we've got New Testament models, and we've got a sense, and I think the starting point, I think you're absolutely right on the starting point, and it was sort of the same kind of starting point that Deanne had the other day on feminist Christianity, is that kind of we're all, you know, we've got a place at which we in effect need to be a repentant people, to see that we all don't have a clear vision. But with that perspective of grace and forgiveness, there's a way in which the language can move other people to see that the sword is not the way.